Welcome to the Analytics Power Hour. Analytics topics covered conversationally and sometimes with explicit language. Here are your hosts, Mo, Michael, and Tim.
Hey everyone, it's the Analytics Power Hour. This is episode 199. You know, one of the tectonic plates in the analytics industry has been sliding around lately and causing a lot of seismic activity, the change in the ability of companies to use attribution to measure media performance and understand contribution. And maybe it was never a great idea to begin with, but anyway, with my two co-hosts, well, we just can't stay away from the topic. And so as the summer sizzles here in the Northern Hemisphere, we want to take another bite of the media measurement apple. Hey, Mo, how you going?
Howdy, I'm excited.
I know. I mean, this is a topic you're dealing with day in, day out.
I mean, using this show to answer my personal questions about measurement, that doesn't sound like me.
And frankly, it works for the listeners too. So let's just keep doing it. Hey, Tim Wilson, how are you doing?
I have not had a frustrating Twitter DM back and forth with somebody who was not listening to what I was trying to say on this topic in 24 hours.
See? So that's perfect. And I'm Michael Helbling. So we're well prepared, but we still needed a guest, someone who could help us elevate the conversation. John Wallace is the CEO of Lift Lab. It's a software as a service company focused on digital media spend optimization. Before that, he founded DataSong, which he exited as he sold it to Neustar. He has his MBA in decision science from George Washington University, and today he is our guest. Welcome to the show, John.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's awesome to have you. John, you go back a long way in this industry, and a lot of people may not remember DataSong, but you worked with a number of very large companies. I mean, talk us through a little bit of your history in the field, because I think that'll help for context.
Yeah, by all means, you know, we were introduced to the topic of attribution working alongside some strong direct marketers. It was companies like Williams-Sonoma and Nordstrom, Saks Fifth Avenue, Eddie Bauer, Express, Wells Fargo. They all had common problems of trying to figure out what spend was incremental. And we were using the path to purchase as our input to figure that out. And that became multi-touch attribution.
So you've moved away from that now. Tell me a little bit about, like, I don't want to be like attribution sucks, because I feel like we could all just like nod our heads and then like move on and that's the end of the show. But like, tell me about your career and like how, I guess, you made those steps towards like MMM, media mix modeling, and more of an experimentation approach.
Mm-hmm. For me, it was always a little bit of concern, no matter how fancy and smart we get the algorithms to become, it's our input data that we're really always going to be worried about. And really, the path to purchase was the input data. It was also the path to not purchase, right? In a well-constructed MTA model, you need to look at the non-converting media as much as the converting media. And as those paths got more and more fragmented by changes in how we collect the data, right? Changes in third-party cookies, ultimately now, more recently, changes in how we can store IDFAs. What was one path to purchase with six events now might look like six different paths. And so that's something I didn't think that it was wise to try to kind of continue to piece together or patch up. I didn't think the band-aids were going to work. And so we had to rethink the problem from scratch.
So, I mean, maybe backing up a little bit. So that sort of the path to purchase was specifically a tracking each individual user and their path to purchase. And that's become fragmented. Was part of the challenge also that even if you track the paths to non-purchase, that you, I've always felt as I feel like the scales have started to fall from my eyes, I'm increasingly realizing that if somebody took a path to purchase, that doesn't necessarily tell you anything about the counterfactual of they might have still taken a path to purchase without some specific marketing intervention, which to me, it's like attribution is you're assigning value, but you're not really necessarily measuring incremental value, no matter how algorithmically and how much machine learning you put behind it. You've got that fundamental challenge of you're working kind of with the data as it's occurring in the wild, as opposed to match market or experimental design where you're you're controlling that data set? I mean, is that the fundamental distinction?
Yeah, there's all flavors of algorithms for multi-touch attribution. The one that we had popularized took into account some of the non-marketing events as well. Again, those algorithms are pretty sophisticated. It's really the input data itself before you ever estimate anything that was becoming more and more of a concern. But yeah, there were approaches to multi-touch attribution, like the one at DataSong, that would look for the incremental effect of marketing. It's just that those paths to purchase are more and more fragmented. I don't think that there was so much noise in the input data, and then we're going to estimate a model on top of that. It became a bit difficult to defend.
So now, I think the thing that I'm finding, I guess, interesting, I obviously haven't been in the industry as long as you. I did start at an attribution agency as well. And pretty much when I was moving on from there, like everyone was starting to talk about MMM again, media mix modeling. And it does seem to be the rage as a in my head now, the way I think about measurement is not one tool. It's about a combination of tools and using the right tool for the specific question you're trying to answer. Whether that's wrong or right, I don't know. Maybe I'll tell you in 20 years. But the thing that I find so fascinating about MMM is like it has actually existed for a very long time. Like, I don't think I necessarily understand why we went through this like blip where we kind of ignored it. And now everyone's back to like, oh, it's the rage.
I mean, I think that the history is pretty long there. I mean, they've been around for a few decades. They were really popularized by consumer packaged goods companies. And I think a lot of digital marketers and DTC brands really saw the appeal of looking at user level data. So it was like, okay, the next generation behind MMM or the next frontier would be to, you know, build these models at the user level. And I remember our data sets were really impressive. It was, you know, millions and millions of observations, right? If you have a million customers and you're looking at 365 day data set and every event that happened and the decay of what's not happened since the last event, it was a really cool longitudinal data sets at the user level. And so we thought we were kind of on a frontier out beyond MMM. Again, when those data sets came apart, you kind of have to look around. And so, you know, our conclusion, actually, we started by building an experiment platform and the MMM came later. So that was chronologically how we got to where we are today.
So if I mount my one soapbox, I feel like it was the digital came along and people were like, well, now we have all this greater, richer data. Therefore, if we just scale that, that will more data, more granular data is better, is more accurate. And we just have to keep chasing that. And nobody ever kind of stopped and looked up. And we chased it kind of to a point, and now we're moving backwards because more and more channels, more and more devices came out. Like, I don't know what peak visibility was or when it occurred. Like, it was probably 10 years ago and there wasn't as many cookie issues. Like, by the time that we hit the point where we were sliding backwards on the visibility, everybody had just bought into this is the way to go. And MMM people, they were easy to kind of, it was, you could kind of dismiss them saying, ah, your MMM model, it takes too long. It's too blunt instrument. It's, you know, it's just overall channel. We're going to be tweaking at the keyword level. And I just feel like the entire industry bought into it and there were no incentives to push back on it. And even now with that going away, it feels like Google and Facebook, you know, the ones who have like a huge media footprint and have visibility within their ecosystem, they're highly incentivized to say, just use us. We still have that user level visibility. So trust us. And yet they're also the ones we're trying to pay. Like, I just want critical thinking out there from marketers to say, this cannot be the way we want to do things. Okay. Let me step down. That's a tall soapbox. Let me be careful here. Let me use my cane. Okay. I'm safely back on the ground.
Jesus.
Thoughts?
it was like a rant. It was like, there's a question at the end. I mean, our brands are spending a lot of money. Our customers are spending a lot of money on these ad platforms. We think of them as partners, and I agree with them, but they should have measurement teams and make measurement broadly available. The further you go up the level of sophistication and the scale of spend, the more likely you'll have people that echo that sentiment that, okay, look, you know, we can't rely on an ad platform to grade their own homework. So I think that it's great that they're making tools available. I think there's not a marketer out there who hasn't run an online conversion lift test, you know, from Facebook. And we were completely aware of all of those approaches and the fact that they were free when we entered the market as Lift Lab. We realized we'd have to perform something a bar above that, right? If that's already kind of the table stakes of the market.
So one question I want to understand, I feel like the data discipline or like people who work in data, I don't know what the right term is, clearly haven't had enough coffee, are largely bought into this. Like, I feel like we understand where the industry is going. I think we understand that like measurement techniques are constantly evolving, things change, and we want to try and do things better over time. From your experience, John, because like you are working with lots of different companies who are going down this path now of like, oh, look, attribution's not working. We're going to have to be using geo experiments or an MMM or some other techniques. Are the marketers bought in?
Yeah, they are. It's helpful. I haven't met an audience yet that argues and says experiments are a bad idea.
Really?
They're kind of a universally accepted as almost too far, actually.
Is there potential selection bias though, that by the time you're talking to them?
Yeah, because I was like, well, I could introduce you to a few people.
Yeah.
And it's not like, in my experience, it's not necessarily that the people I'm talking to are opposed, but I will get feedback like, well, what could we do if we didn't want to do media mix modeling? Since we can't really do multi-touch attribution anymore, what else could we do instead? And it's like, what do you mean? Like, you could, let's do some holdout tests, but eventually we're going to need to model this out. Right. So anyways, I do find there are some people, but I am encouraged, I guess, to a certain extent that you are finding people fairly receptive to this, because I think there is sort of a continuum of marketers, if you will.
I find that they're really typically warm to the experiment side of things. Maybe it goes back to eighth grade science class or something like that. Everyone likes a good experiment. Not the same reception on the modeling side. Sometimes there's more concern, questions to be answered, you know, understanding a methodology or at least high level. What we found is that it's putting the two together that is makes it extremely complementary and extremely comprehensive. So we like to say that the modeling approach to your historical data gives you instant coverage and it's always on. And the experiments go hand in hand. They give you the precision. So if anybody has ever looked at the results of a marketing mix model, or if you've ever downloaded Robin and run your data through a package like that, what you should expect to see is that the model is not perfect. It's a model. I think someone had a great expression. It was that all models are wrong. Some models are useful. It's a statistician.
George Box.
Yep, Mr. Box.
George Box. Yeah.
And I'm a big, you know, believer in that. And so we should expect that in a first cut at a mixed model that there's some question marks that come along with that. And often it's not really the model that we should be blaming, right? Don't shoot the messenger. It might just be the data. If you have really low signal data, let's say you're modeling 15 channels and you kind of look at the model and it looks pretty good for 10 out of 15 or 11 out of 15. What are you going to do about the other four? You know, are you going to, you have one choice, which is kind of to torture the data as much as you can. But if there's no signal in the data, there's just no signal in the data. And our answer is, let's go kick off an experiment and let's go gather better data. So we have these two measurement approaches tied at the hip. And so where one, you know, one, where one has precision, it's still going to be a point in time exercise. And that's complemented by the modeling side that has a kind of comprehensive view of the data, is always on. And when you fuse these two together, you have a really nice, very complementary signals.
Okay. I want to get to the crux of like the whole reason I asked you to be on the show and the actual question that I really want to ask. Okay. So here we go. The output that we get from an MMM or an experiment, and I am very happy to be corrected. This is me very genuinely wanting to learn and understand how the hell to do this well. It is very different to the output that we get from like MTA reporting, right? In my mind, the output looks different. And the thing that I'm trying to reconcile in my head is, yes, we have better data. Yes, we're going to make hopefully better decisions with that data. But there is still this expectation from the business of what a report looks like, or like what the output should look like. Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking, like, in my head, a very traditional, like, and we have one as well, which is kind of like a, I don't know, I'm going to call it a dashboard, but maybe it's not a dashboard, a scorecard, whatever, of like, these are the channels. This is how many conversions they drove. This was the cost per convert. Like, and I look at that daily or weekly, and like in my head, I can't reconcile the output that we're getting from an MMM and an experiment and those reporting expectations by finance or marketers or whatever.
I think we've addressed their concerns. Yeah, I think we've addressed their concerns. If you think about what are people looking at today, most of the people listening, their marketing teams, the data that they're looking at, their input data, are quite often in-platform reported performance, right? So self-attributed revenue, you know, as the app platforms would report it, or they're looking at last click coming out of Google Analytics or Adobe. And their analytic technique is typically pre-post analysis. So that's what we're walking into. And so that dashboard that you're talking about, I don't know if it's one that's put together with last click data out of Google Analytics, or if it's one that's done with platform reporting, but we're replacing those two. We'll put them side by side with the numbers in our platform, but it has all the same levels of granularity. It goes campaign, it goes down to tactic, and goes down, or it goes campaign, tactic, and channel. So building from the bottom. And that's what they're used to seeing in their last click reporting or their in-platform reporting. It's just that we've now put the incremental number as opposed to the one that, you know, is somewhat, we all know is somewhat biased.
And that, I mean, that incremental number is like, that is that fundamental shift, right? Because an experiment or MMM has the concept, it's got incrementality completely baked into the language, which means there's, in an MMM, there's kind of an intercept. This is mm-hmm. revenue you would have gotten anyway. With an experiment, I'm just looking at the change, the effect, the incremental effect, whereas attribution, the traditional MTA is going to say, we're taking the full pot and we're going to spread it out across everything, which mm-hmm. seems like it is almost always going to, it's got a bigger pot to play with because it kind of is biased against incrementality, right?
You're right. I mean, the notions of incrementality, but I like its big brother, actually, diminishing returns.
I was about to talk about diminishing returns, okay. So I'm excited.
So I think of it in the other direction, that if you can decipher diminishing returns, incrementality is along for the ride. So in a diminishing return curve, we know the incrementality at every spend level. You can't say that in the other direction. If you run an online conversion lift test in Facebook and you're spending $1,000 a day, you're going to get the incrementality for that spend level. If you triple your spend, that incrementality is no longer valid. You need to retest it. And so that's fundamentally what was the appeal for us, was how could we set up an experiment approach that was designed around diminishing returns and then complement that with MMM, which has got diminishing returns built into it. And that's how these two fit together so well. And so we don't ignore incrementality, but like I like to say, it's along for the ride.
But that means your experiments, you're varying the level of spend so that you're getting a curve.
Yeah, the traditional A/B go dark test we found is not sufficient for most marketing analytics. And I want to pose this to you. Has anyone here run a test and actually seen negative lift? Has that ever happened to you?
On media?
Yeah, a media test.
Yes.
I think so.
Yeah. So let's ask ourselves, what happened? It could be something mechanically wrong, but most likely you're just up against natural variation of the data. You were the unlucky test where the control group performed better than the treatment group. And what we typically do is sweep those under the rug. But now if you think about the other end of the distribution, what if you landed and you were the lucky test and you're now over-reporting the ROAS or the return on investment? So that's what we found, is that the traditional A/B tests that we all love them, we run them all the time. We think they're better suited for things like doing, you know, creative testing or subject line testing, things like that. And that if you really want to understand the economics of an ad platform, you need to learn more on diminishing returns, and your experiment designs need to take you towards understanding diminishing returns.
So now we're going to get really into my head and the weirdness that's going on. So, okay, diminishing return curves. I'm on board. Like, I'm going to refer to Sam. He's the measurement lead at Canva, and him and I spend a lot of time talking about this. And by us talking, I mean him trying to educate me. I understand diminishing return curves, and I understand that the goal over time is to change the shape, right? So that it becomes more efficient. The bit that I'm struggling with is, like, I understand it and Sam understands it. How do you, like, I think a marketer understands a diminishing return curve. I'm trying to understand, how do you get them to understand that you want to change the shape, and how do you actually report that to the business? Do you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. you can't be like, I mean, I guess you could be like, this is what it used to look like, and now here's what the curve looks like. But, like, I can't find a way in my head that that will actually work.
Right. So we don't, back to the dashboard question, where the two use cases that we're showing our marketing customers are, we will turn the curves into incrementality and talk about what was the incrementality of each of your channels, each of the spend of each of your channels last week. And the other is the more forward looking, the optimization. And so we don't have to show the curve itself or ask people to try to, you know, put a bunch of curves on the screen and interpret them. We're able to show them the type of metrics that they're already familiar with, but powered by the advances in understanding a curve.
But do you think we should be educating them?
It depends on the level of appetite, right? So those curves are there and they can be viewed, and we have some power users that want to see them. But if we were to lead, you know, an onboarding with, this is how you understand a curve, and I, you know, we probably would lose a lot of the audience that way.
So I guess back to the, and I feel like we're peppering you with questions about the, these are the resistance that, I mean, I can say that I feel like I run into, and one we haven't touched on is the multi-touch attribution data. Another thing, not only is it, oh, this is this user level data, it's more data and it's good. It feels free. You know, it's, we're going to run Google Analytics or the ad platform. That's just part of, we run the conversion pixel. It just happens. We do whatever we think is best, and there's no cost, minimal incremental cost to report on it, because the tool just spits it out. Whereas to run an experiment, and presumably even the more sophisticated experiment, and certainly having technology and expertise behind it can drive efficiencies, that says effectively you need to take some of your dollars that you would have spent on Google Ads and instead invest in actually reliable measurement, which in my experience, like in the abstract, that's not that hard of a story to say. When it comes down to saying, yes, you should cut your budget by 50 grand so you can learn it, that's all of a sudden they're like, well, yeah.
Tim, we do the opposite. We have a measurement budget that we agree with finance that sits separate from the marketers. That is like our measurement and experimentation budget. And then it's not a like, hey, marketer, do you want to give me some money to do this? It's like that pot of money is set aside at the start of the year, which, like,
I think that's great. That's not, I mean, that's 100% not that we have, I work with clients that have money for bodies and maybe for tooling. Typically, that's not the, I mean, and that may be the way to go at it.
Can you like hide it in your tooling budget as like a, just throw it in there and just hope that
it's, well, because it's hard because it's the tooling and it's the agencies that are managing the budget that have to be coordinated with, right? It, like, it gets pretty murky. I mean, I love that as an idea, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, but part of the spirit of what we put together at Lift Lab is that we're most frequently measuring campaigns that are already in production, and they're actually baked into the marketer's forecast, and they can't really have a risk of an experiment impacting the performance. So these are special designs that are there. You do need to have money to cover the tooling, but you don't need none of our customers have it per se, an experimentation budget where we're going to just take these dollars and run some media. It's typically testing on media that's already live, that's right, already production. And it's the job of the experiment design to minimize any opportunity costs. So we're not forcing people to buy PSA ads, for example.
Well, and I guess that's where, I mean, I'll position it that way, saying this is spending the same money, but spending it in a smarter way so that you're basically injecting a degree of variability into the data. You're controlling the data you're collecting to get the variability so that you can construct a curve. And maybe it is that it is the tooling and, I mean, do you wind up needing to coordinate with, are you running the media through the, through like the Lyft Lab technology or so you're actually running the media
the interventions on the campaigns show up as different forms depending on the experiment design, but what you typically see are some form of targeting exclusions or inclusions. You see some changes in spend, which the agency would refer to as pacing. And for the major ad platforms, yes, that's happening through the APIs into the major ad platforms. If it's a smaller ad platform that maybe doesn't have a right API, then we'll be coordinating with the agency for them to traffic the experiment. Yeah.
So then I've got to ask, like, so if it's through a pacing, if it's through, if there's a degree that's through coordinating with the agency, how often do they flub that?
Fuck it up.
Like that?
Interesting question.
I mean, to me, it's like 100% of the time, and partly because it is introducing like a different, and they're like, yeah, but no, we flipped the switch to do the auto optimizing, right? I mean, they're so conditioned to the magic of the machine, they struggle, and I honestly think there's some conscious or subconscious fear that they might be exposed, that I don't think they're super incentivized to make it run correctly. Do you run into that?
I've never run into that. I'm not sure what you're talking about.
There you go. Just like you said, every marketer wants to do experimentation.
You're under no obligation to incriminate yourself in this conversation, Sean, because Tim's flying free here.
But what's been actually useful is quite often you can make lemonade out of lemons. If someone, let's say by accident, overdoes it and cuts the budget too far, they could overshoot by accident. They actually just give more data points that we're filling in a distribution of spend. So when we give instructions to the agency, we say, directionally, this is what we'd like you to do. But if you over or under, it's not going to matter. So we've made a sample design that embraces that, as opposed to what we don't want is to hang a sign on the door that says, quiet, please, testing in progress, right? Because that's just not going to work. There's going to be interruptions. In the middle of an experiment, you could just have the CFO say, you know, look, we need to spend more. We're behind on our revenue numbers. And you can't interrupt that test or say we can't spend that money because there's a test in progress. So we see those as opportunities, right? It's just going to give us more confidence in the results. It could be in the other direction. It could be that they were running hot and they needed to cut some budget out. And that gives us yet more points along the curve. So we actually just embrace it.
But I guess that's critical you may have the experiment design, but really what you're working with is the experiment as is. Like, you've got to have reliable data on what was spent where and how and the targeting, right? I mean, I guess, and maybe this is, I've been through it more in kind of a manual process where here's the design doesn't get, you know, there's not full compliance. So then we take in what the actual was, and that's how then the analysis of the experiment happens, but we've kind of sometimes struggled to get a straight answer on exactly where the spend actually did happen. I don't know.
Another great question for you, John.
Well, I'm turning it into a question. You have all of the conditions that could happen in the wild. You could have where you implemented a go dark group and there was no spend. You could have a condition where you were spending down. And then you have sometimes what's called leakage, where you intended to go dark, but there was still some spending that are happening. And the designs and the analytics of the data that's collected have to be robust to all of those conditions. So that's why we don't rely on just a straight two-cell A-B test or expanding that out to multiple cells. And the unlock here, Tim, comes is that, you know, we've embraced how do we marry experimental design with really time series analysis. And that's a differentiator, and it gives us a lot of robustness to when things don't go as planned.
John, one thing, you've mentioned experimental design quite a few times, and I'd like to dig into that a little bit. This shit is hard and really complicated. And like, I mean, we've already talked about kind of like one situation that you've managed to, I guess, account for, which is like you have an experiment design and the spend levels don't go exactly as planned. I guess what I'm trying to understand is like for the, you know, the analyst sitting there who's like, oh, I actually really, really want to start with this. Like, how, like in my head, I'm thinking about complexities of like location data and all that sort of stuff. Like, tell me a little bit more about that process. Like, is this one of those things that if you're going to start down this journey, you just need to have in your head the expectation, and you need to set this expectation with the business. We're going to do this because we're going to make hopefully better decisions from it, but it is going to be a hard thing to execute well? Or like, what's the path like once you start down it?
I can answer that from, if I put myself in the shoes of an analyst getting started on this, and I think it was a hard path for us. We had really, we were just, you know, lucky to have early adopter customers that wanted to kind of see that level of innovation and, you know, see the scientists coming out of the lab and trying to figure out what went wrong. And they did, and they were patient, and they reaped the benefit. And that'll happen for your firm as well. If you're endeavoring on something like this, the payoffs can be quite handsome. So there's the difficulty part. You know, this is a road that's been traveled. You will end up in a better place because of it. And in our case, you know, the customers that are coming onto the platform are benefiting from a lot of those lessons learned in the trenches, hot fought. And we now have made it a lot more, you know, just highly repeatable. You almost asked me, like, you know, we've danced around this a little bit on the call, like, you know, what do you actually get out of one of these, right? Like, you know, is it better reporting? You know, I'm not motivated by reports and good looking reports. I'm always motivated by how do we increase profit? And this is what I've really enjoyed about popularizing these approaches, is that our answer will only be, we should cut spend because we'll make more profit, or we'll increase spend because we'll make more profit. That's the only two answers. And occasionally you're already completely at the apex of the profit curve and you can stay put. And the order of magnitude of this, we've seen experiments bring back anywhere from under $1 million to over $40 million in a single experiment in opportunity, right? So it's the whole gamut. And that's what keeps us excited about it.
Is there a, I guess maybe it's your speaking channel, but is there a, we can spend the same amount, but shift, rebalance how we spend it and make more profit, presumably?
Absolutely. If you have two curves, we love the double whammy where you cut from one channel and increase profit and move it into another channel that was underspent and increase profit again. That's everyone's favorite outcome. And that's usually when you have either you've run a bunch of experiments or you have a model that's also looking at all the diminishing return curves for you.
So when you're doing experiments, and I guess this is, are you doing them on, you said kind of at the campaign tactic channel, are you running basically multifactorial experiments? I mean, there's the curve, but are you hitting multiple channels and multiple campaigns in one experiment?
Occasionally. So the way it works is our outcome variable is it isn't any of the attributed revenue. It's nothing to do with what you would see in the platform. It's nothing to do with the last click. It's against total sales. And so therefore, we're not analyzing maybe one campaign at a time. These are typically at the channel level or the tactic level where we can measure against a pretty big outcome. But the modeling side of Lift Lab, and we've been talking experiments for a few minutes, there we're modeling along a hierarchy where we're modeling the multi-channel approach that we traditionally call MMM. And we go two steps further down that hierarchy into tactics and into campaigns. So that's how these are, again, complementary. We might learn something in experiment that shifts the model at the tactic level, but that'll flow down to what we're learning at the campaign level.
Can you explain a little bit more about that? Technically, how do you use experiment results to recalibrate the MMM output?
Yeah, I'll speak to it at a high level. You need first to have experiment designs that think in terms of diminishing returns, because that's what your model is doing. And when you have that unlocked, now you have an ability to calibrate and say, okay, I need to move this curve up or down. I have better signal from the experiment. But you want to have your cake and eat it too, because the experiment's point in time. So if you can feed that into the model, but the model can keep learning from that point as it sees new data, now you actually have the best of both worlds. And that's part of what we got excited about when we were standing up the methodology.
Does the mix modeling, I mean, I think of experimental design says we're going to design an experiment, start the experiment. The data we're using is from the data that we're ultimately processing is from the start to the end of the experiment. Whereas my understanding of mix modeling is it's taking your historical data, incorporating time series and other factors, and modeling that. When you talk about the modeling side, like how are you needing to feed in some pile of historical data, a year, 2 years, mm-hmm. 3 months, 2 weeks? Like, is that the right way to think about it? And then you're building more data, I guess, as you're running the experiment to feed into it.
Yeah, think of it as you'll get census data, census of your spend into the model. So that's typically, in our case, a year of daily data for every channel, right? As well as all your outcomes that you're studying. And that data is collected along that hierarchy. So channel, tactic, and campaign. And that's the input ingredients for the modeling side. And then anywhere where you're running an experiment, there might be an overlap period. So let's say part of your year of data that you modeled has whatever, you know, a recent month in it. And that might be a month where you had an experiment. And that's where you get a chance to do calibration, is where's the overlap? What's the model saying for the month of January? And what's the experiment said that we ran in January? And that's the ability to true them up.
For that modeling side, do you run into like channels like out of home where, like, you know, there's a billboard that's up for 6 months or a year and daily data feels weird? Do you run into the offline channels where there isn't kind of digital has daily, but non-digital?
Also, like COVID, COVID just like fucked everyone's data?
It totally did. Anyone who was relying on a mixed model kind of just had a bit of a, you know, their heart dropped to their stomach when they realized what a change in the dynamic that just happened. We had a lot of customers that had experiments live when COVID hit. And so they had literally feelers in the ad platform of what just changed. Think about an experiment where you're running simultaneously three different spend conditions intentionally, and they all shift down or all shift up, or the spend up shifts by more than the spend down. So that's instrumentation, I would call it, in the campaigns. And so, yes, anyone who's working with weekly data and COVID enters, they're going to have to do some pretty big surgery to those models to reflect that. In our case, anywhere where we had live experiments, we didn't have to think about it too much. We had really hard factual data on how should the model adjust to this new reality.
All right, it's time, and you know what time it is. It's time for the Conductrix quiz. Yes, the quizzical query, where we pitch a question to my two co-hosts, Mo and Tim, as they compete for one of our listeners. As you know, the Analytics Power Hour and the Conductrix Quiz are sponsored by Conductrix. They build industry-leading experimentation software for A/B testing, adaptive optimization, and predictive targeting. For more information on how Conductrix can help you with those types of programs, visit Conductrix.com. All right, let's get to the quiz. Mo, would you like to know who you are competing on behalf of?
Sure thing.
It's listener Ben Woodard, who's actually a great friend of the show. And Tim, would you like to know who you're competing for?
I'll wait till after to find out.
Afterwards, okay. No,
you can go ahead.
Andrew Davies is who you're competing for. So very excited. Here we go with the question. All right. While Data Science Insiders Today argue over the benefits of open source software such as R and Python, it wasn't always that way. Back before anyone used the term data science, folks who had the same type of gig would instead likely use proprietary software like SAS for their statistical work. SAS was originally created for the mainframe. What mainframe language was SAS originally written in? Hint! The SAS data step has a similar syntax to this language. Is it A, PL/1, B, JCL, C, COBOL, D, REX, or E, APL?
Oh, boy.
Well, I mean, the benefit is that I am not old enough to know the answer to this. So I'm glad we have the jump on the bus option available to me.
I don't know if even Tim is old enough to know the answer. Honestly,
I have one confident elimination.
Okay.
Which is, I think COBOL does not feel right as being the right COBOL kind of language to work. So I'm going to go with an eliminating COBOL.
We can go back to Y2K and say, yes, that is correct. We can eliminate COBOL. So we now have A, PL-1, B, JCL, D, REX, or E, APL.
I'm going to eliminate one purely because I don't like how it's spelt. which is D-Rex. I don't understand why it has two X's. Maybe I'll Google it afterwards.
Rex. All right. Yeah, me neither. And what a great intuition, Mo. That is correct. We can eliminate Rex because you don't like how it's spelled. Which, incidentally, that's how a lot of computer decisions got made in the early days. So, I mean, really, you're right there. With your ahead of your time, before your time, you have an old soul. I don't know what the right way to say it is. Anyways, now we're down to three.
I feel like just out of, I mean, the PL/1, JCL, and APL all feel like they are legit languages. The L probably stands for L in all of them. I am going to go just on a flyer and say that I think it is APL.
It is
and that's
APL.
A total guess. So now I think Mo can
either choose different or bandwagon.
I'm not going to bandwagon because the odds are in my favor here.
Okay. So do you have a choice or do you want me to just...
No, I don't have to choose.
No, you just think he's wrong. And your choice was APL, Tim?
Oh, yes, this is exciting. It was.
This is very tense. Tim, you are not correct. It is not APL. So Mo, that means you're the winner, Ben Woodard. You're also the winner, which incidentally, Ben knows a lot of R. So this is awesome because it's sort of connected. Anyways, the answer is PL-1. One nicety of this was if the customer database was on a mainframe, you could write the code that would encode your statistical targeting model right in the data step. Then with minimal modification, you could send it to the mainframe to apply the model and use it to cut the mail files for targeting, which would be in the form of separate reels of 9-track magnetic tape for each targeting segment and control for use in direct mail campaigns. This is amazing. Like some real Hidden Figures type stuff.
That was
right
my
here.
Fault.
Yeah, that's what it reminds me of. That movie is awesome, by the way. Okay, that's not about the conductor quiz, but Ben Woodard, you're a winner. Mo, great job. You're a winner just by having enough skepticism, which was something doesn't smell right. You might be right. Okay. Thank you to Conductrix for sponsoring the Conductor's Quiz. And let's get back to the show. You know, I think a couple questions. So first question, how much does diplomacy factor into what you do? And second question, a lot of people listening are certainly analytics folks who are interested in going deeper in this topic, but don't have a depth of experience. How would you advise someone in a journey towards a deeper understanding of both experimentation and maybe media mix modeling as they kind of trying to progress in working better with their marketing teams and things like that?
Well, I mean, we have to have diplomacy. I mean, this is an analytics power hour. And so
that's right. No marketers listen to this show. So you're totally safe.
Or agencies, or media agencies for that matter.
So, this is an analytics power hour. And part of the diplomacy we have to have is establishing our credibility with the analytics teams that we're partnering with. They may have already built a mixed model once and maybe not quite, you know, got it all the way to finish. That's been reported to us before. So our diplomacy is, can we be good stewards of your data? Can we be very transparent? Here's the model. Here's the good news of the model. Here's the bad news. Here's the dirty laundry of your model. And when we're running experiments, those are running in the customer's ad accounts. So everything's completely in front of them. Can we show you how we analyze the data that came out of the experiment? And then to the question Mo asked earlier, can we show you how the calibration from the experiment got pushed into the model? All of this is happening in a transparent way with customers that have the appetite to ask the questions. So there's a lot of diplomacy. And we like to think of it as I've never met an analytics team that was underworked. So if this is an area, if this is an area where we've specialized and we can collaborate with the analytics team, but bring in some repeatability, then it's a win-win. That frees up some time to go do things that are closer to the line of business. You know, maybe it's some super secret analytics about how to make the product better or something like that, that you could never buy right from an industry. When you said diplomacy, that's what popped in my head. And we do that every day. We just collaborate with a lot of smart people.
So I guess on the diplomacy front, as you said, we could spend less and make the same, like presumably you have experiments that run that say the response curve is flat. Like we went high, we went low, and we're not detecting it, which is the sort of thing that could, I think rocks the world of the marketer, like kind of upsetting? And do you wind up getting after the fact like, hey, we ran it. It was valid. It was well designed. We'll go into all the detail you want, but we can't tell that this is doing anything. You should pull out of this channel. Like, does that happen?
I like to think of it both ways, that all channels are profitable. I've just never seen any marketing that makes revenue go down. And so it really becomes answering the economic question of, did the last dollar that I spend cover its cost? And to your point, Tim, there's been a lot of examples where people have looked at misleading numbers and made some really inaccurate investment decisions in that media. I know we have one example where they had done their homework. They did an incrementality test and they said, okay, and that's the traditional one that says, hey, you know, 70% of the number coming out of the ad platform is believable. And then they proceeded to increase their spend considerably. And they made the assumption that that was going to scale linearly, that they would keep getting 70% incrementality. Yeah. Now, Mo might know where this story is going. I mean, with that sound, it's likely that you're going to start buying different types of inventory. You'll be spending deeper into audiences. And that's exactly what happened to them. They added some different placements and things like that. But they kept that assumption of 70%. When they ran the first Lift Lab experiment, we kind of had to triple check the numbers. We hadn't quite seen something that far underwater. And what was cool here is that the brand was like, okay, we see what you did with the Go Dark. We see what you did with the pacing. We see where you got this. We're just going to take the rest of the country down 50% now, 50% overnight. And guess what happened to sales?
Nothing.
Stayed flat.
Nothing.
Nothing.
And they took it down another 20% was what we recommended. And that freed up an awful lot of budget. Oh, no. Now, if you, you know, there's a.
And they put it all into affiliate marketing?
it's really your chance as a marketer to go and do some proper branding campaigns that you don't expect to kind of, you know, measure right away or something like that. It becomes a fund of money where you can, you know, or you might have performance channels where there's still a lot of profit left in the curve, if you can go move the money over there.
Or try new channels, right? Like there are new channels emerging. Absolutely. If it's going to be TikTok or connected TV or something that a lot of brands aren't spending in yet. Like it seems like that could be the strategy, is try to free up what you're freeing but up to now do this in an experimental
hold
way.
Hold on for just like maybe 2 more years on the metaverse, people. Come on. Just let's hold off.
Right.
I don't even know what this friggin' thing is yet.
I think the 3D ad's gonna do really well, actually.
Oh, I'm sure it's probably gonna be amazing. I'm only saying that because you know you're gonna be in a meeting in a week where they're like, we want to put some budget behind the metaverse.
Tim, our least likely, an anecdote for you. We have a B2B company that they said they're going to run a campaign on TikTok. And I thought, this is probably the biggest waste of money that we'll have ever seen, right? I was just skeptical. And, you know, how are you going to find B2B buyers on TikTok? But they listened and did run that through, instead of trying to do pre-post analysis, they ran it through a randomized control trial. And the numbers don't lie, and I was wrong. My intuition was that they would be, you know, those dollars would be underwater, but they actually, all the money that they trafficked was in the money, and they actually had evidence from the diminishing return curve that they could continue to spend up, that they could scale spend. Now, part of that, what's in a diminishing return curve? It's price, right? So it's cheaper media at this point in time, you know, at least on TikTok, and it's response. They actually had a great agency who did really good TikTok native creative that looked really nice, that got the likes and they got the responses out of it. And so they can spend up comfortably on a new channel. And someone's asked the question, you know, what about new channels? And I like to say, instead of a go dark test, it's a rollout test, right? So let's go spend in 20 or 30% of the country and measure it without doing
try podcast advertising. By
yeah,
golly.
Sure. The more specialized and niche focused, the better. Yeah.
John, are you seeing, because you're like working with all these different clients, and I'm not going to lie, the experiment results, I just feel like all the results you get to see must just be like the funnest thing ever. And your team must just be like sitting on Fridays having drinks being like, oh my God, like, did you expect this? I mean, that's what it's like in my head. Are you now kind of banking up, I guess, this experience around, this is what we often see with this particular type of test? Or are you finding that the results really do vary across, like, yeah, B2B and B2C and country and so many other things?
Yeah, it's actually both. We're starting to see some patterns emerge, but we go into every test with the data will do the talking kind of attitude. Mm. And so, and what we're learning is that you could take, one of my favorites is the third rail of marketing, right? It's the branded search spend, you know, and too many times the debate becomes too polarizing. Like you should never do branded search or you should maximize your branded search. We've done a number of those tests and we've gotten both answers back, quite frankly. Sometimes people have underspent on it and sometimes people are dramatically overspent on it. It really depends on where they are and that's going to vary from brand to brand. We just put it under the exact same lens as every other channel, which is let's find the point that we can spend to which we can spend where our last dollar is covering its own, you know, its own, that we're generating, covering the own cost. It's no different. The economics are different, right? As you move out of impression-based media, the amount that you're spending doesn't have as much as an effect on the price. With click-based media, the more you spend and the more you're willing to spend in the auction, the more your unit price goes up. And these are all of the dynamics that are going into what we called earlier in the call, like diminishing return curves.
All right. Well, we do have to start to wrap up, but these have been excellent. This has been an excellent conversation, John. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I've been taking mad notes as we've been talking and really benefiting from sort of some of your experiences and learnings as you've kind of done this for many, many years. And I'm sure our listeners are as well. One thing we like to do is do a last call. Anything of interest to our listeners that you might want to share? John, you're our guest. Do you have a last call you'd like to share?
You know, what I can't get enough of right now are trust constraint algorithms. They're, you know, out there, widely available, freely available for doing nonlinear optimization. And if you've got a lot of diminishing return curves, they sure do come in handy.
Trust constraint. Can you define that in like two more sentences?
They literally are algorithms for solving large nonlinear solution spaces. And what you could think that we're using them for is to say, if I had another $1,000, where would I spend it? Or if I were able to move my spend around, if I wanted to keep the same budget but reallocate it, how would I do that? And they lend themselves very well to it.
Very cool. Nice. Well, we'll have to find a link for that.
Trust constrained optimization.
There you go. All right. Mo, what about you? What's your last call?
So this comes via the new data PM working at Canva. Well, she's not new. She's been at Canva forever, but her name's Jay-Z and she sent it to me and it's called An Overachiever's Guide to Rest by Elaine Chao. And look, I'm not going to lie. When I read it, I was like, I'm really not an overachiever. Like none of these attributes match up to me at all. But I did find the comments on rest incredibly helpful. I recommend reading it because she's got a series of different kind of recommendations. But the one that probably stuck with me the most, which is something that I've really been thinking a lot about, is see rest as an investment in your future self. Like I think it's something that we actually don't prioritize, and particularly like rest and time away from work. Like we think, well, I often feel guilty about it, but actually like sometimes creating space from work, I actually do my best thinking weirdly about work, or like it just like I have an epiphany about something. So yeah, I recommend, I just feel like the world after the last few years, everyone's feeling a little bit more burnt out, and anything you can do to kind of help yourself reset and get in a better mental health space is a good thing.
Nonsense. Poppycock, I say.
I think Tim needs to read it most of all.
I think if you apply a trust constraint algorithm to that, Tim, you might find something different. But anyway, Tim, what about you? What's your last call?
My last call, I would have thought I had this as something along these lines as the last call in the past, and I can't find a record that I did. But Michael Lewis's podcast, Against the Rules, which
you
has had.
Definitely mentioned it.
I feel like I have,
you
but
definitely okay. have, but it's a good reminder because I forgot to listen to it and now I can listen to
but
it.
But this is going to be a specific, he wrapped up season 3 a couple of months ago back in May, and season 3 episode 4 is called Respect the Polygon. And it goes into uncertainty and probabilistic thinking. I actually think season 3 has been my favorite season of his. They're only, I don't know, 5 or 6 episodes per season. He actually has Nate Silver on. He has a weatherman on who's talks about Respect the Polygon. Nate Silver actually is not horribly annoying. And I guess the link for me is that I remember reading in Nate Silver's book, the weather, talking about weather prediction. But it is a very good sort of discussion of how we try to take in and interpret uncertainty. And it's done in kind of the really fun kind of Michael Lewis sort of self-deprecating, inquisitive way. I think the whole season, I think all of them are good.
Wait.
Yes, Mo.
Can I have a two for today, please, sir?
Wait. Don't tell me. Also an excellent podcast.
Yes.
No, that probably wasn't what it was going
to
be.
Hold on. Let's go to the judges. Okay. Yep. Totally allowed, Mo.
Okay, great. Mark Edmondson has a new book that's coming out, Learning Google Analytics, Creating Business Impact and Driving Insights. And I did actually message him because I was like, look, I just want to understand, like, is this a real intro level book? And he's like, no, it's definitely definitely. When it said learning Google Analytics, I was like, well, this doesn't sound like Mark. Mark is like one of the most technical people I know. So my understanding is it's like more of an intermediate level and like talks a little bit about Google Cloud and that sort of stuff. But I am like very pumped about this and also incredibly impressed because how that man has time to do all the shit that he does is still beyond me. But anyway, that was my twofer.
Awesome.
Excellent. That's a worthwhile. Good one. Michael, do you have a last call? Or did you cede yours to Mo?
Well, no, half of it. So with our last remaining last call. So I've been accused of having highly applicable last calls. And so I'm going to look it out to change all that. So this one is very non-applicable to your job, but it's something I really enjoy and mess around with from time to time, which is this little application that uses, I think, some natural language programming and stuff like that behind the scenes, like GPT-3, to produce art. And so you put in a word or a phrase and then you pick a style and it generates a picture. So it's at app.wombo.art and it's super fun to mess with. Has nothing to do with analytics except for maybe some of the crazy math that's happening behind the scenes, but I enjoy it.
Jim Stern will attest to the fact that I actually did do that as a last call and he went and tried it out. So
did you really?
That's awesome. I did.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, I know that I did not hear about it from you.
I'm used to being the late arriver. I mean, it took me like 5 years to get an Oculus after you touted it. And now you've run away because it's...
Well, yeah, because I deleted my Facebook account. So now I can't use my Oculus Go. Anyway, that has nothing to do with this topic. Anyway, John, what a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you so much for coming on, first and foremost.
Thanks so much for having me.
And of course, no show would be complete without a huge thank you to Josh Crowhurst, our producer, who does so much behind the scenes to make sure this show is the shining example of analytics excellence you've come to expect. I say that fairly tongue in cheek, but it seems to work out okay. And you've put up with us all these years. So we'll keep doing it. And of course, I know that I speak for both of my co-hosts, Mo and Tim. No matter what kind of experimentation or media mix model you're running, the most important thing you can do is keep analyzing.
Thanks for listening. Let's keep the conversation going with your comments, suggestions, and questions on Twitter at Analytics Hour, on the web at analyticshour.io, our LinkedIn group, and the Measure Chat Slack group. Music for the podcast by Josh Crowhurst.
So smart guys wanted to fit in, so they made up a term called analytics. Analytics don't work.
Analytics. Oh my God. What the fuck does that even mean?
Rock flag and diminishing return curves.